Good afternoon. I'm John Gallen, and I'm the director of the Clinical Center. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to the 10th NIH Astute Clinician Lecture. And it's especially a pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker, who's a long friend. I want to send regards from Dr. Zahuni, who wanted to be here to actually introduce Dr. Kohler, but unfortunately got called out for some other activity and regrets that he won't be here. The Astute Clinician Lectureship was established in 1998 by the very generous gift of the late Dr. Robert Miller and his wife, Haruko. Their gift honors a U.S. scientist who has observed and investigated an unusual clinical occurrence, which has then opened an important new avenue of research. And I think today's speaker certainly meets the vision of this lectureship. Our speaker is Dr. Barry Kohler, who is currently the David Rockefeller Professor of Medicine and head of the Laboratory of Blood and Vascular Biology at the Rockefeller University. He is also Physician in Chief and Vice President for Medical Affairs at Rockefeller. Dr. Kohler is a magna cum laude graduate of Columbia College, and then he attended New York University School of Medicine. And that's where I met Dr. Kohler when he was an intern and I was a resident. And we have great stories, great friendships that we've shared together since then. He completed his residency at Bellevue in New York City and then came down to the NIH, where he took advanced training in hematology and clinical pathology here at the Clinical Center under Dr. Harvey Graulnick. After he completed that experience, he joined the faculty at Stony Brook and eventually became the clinical director and head of the hematology division and a consulting physician at Northport VA Medical Center and clinical chief of the University Hospital Hematology Lab, among other prestigious positions. There, he was awarded the title of Distinguished Service Professor of Medicine and Pathology in 1993. And it's there that he did much of his research that has been a common trail to the present, focusing on hemostasis, thrombosis, and platelet physiology. And indeed, I can remember visiting Barry at Stony Brook in this very lovely laboratory, and I was at the time studying electrophoretic mobility of white cells, and I had at the NIH this fancy Zeiss apparatus, and Barry had a fish tank. It was doing the same sort of measurements, but in a very simplified system. And Barry's data was phenomenally elegant and really beautiful. I won't talk about my data. Kohler studied the defect in patients with Glanzmann thrombasthenia, which affects one person in a million and involves lifelong excessive bleeding. He studied the defect in these patients' platelets that affects their ability to aggregate. And based on this knowledge, his laboratory developed an antibody that blocks the ability of normal platelets to aggregate. A derivative of that antibody has been shown to prevent complications of coronary interventions, such as angioplasty and stent insertion, and has been used to treat more than 2 million patients worldwide. For this work, he was a recipient or co-recipient of an important patent, and in total he has 13 U.S. patents. He's also developed an assay to assess platelet function and has received the FDA approval to monitor antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and other agents. He's received many awards, and I'll just comment on a few. These include the American Society of Hematology Henry M. Stratton Medal and the Robert J. and Claire Passereau Foundation Award for cardiovascular research, which he won in 2005. His antibody was named Best New Therapeutic Product by the Biotechnology Industry Organization in 1995. And in 1997, he was named Inventor of the Year by the New York Intellectual Property Law Association and received the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis Distinguished Career Award. Dr. Kohler is a member of the Association of American Physicians, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies, and the National Academy of Sciences. He is a fellow of the New York Academy of Medicine and the American Association of the Advancement of Science, as well as the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Here at the NIH, he served on many committees. He's currently a member of the NHLBI's Board of Extramural Advisors and co-chairs of the NIH's Advisory Board of Clinical Research, which he just completed a few months ago. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Kohler, who's going to tell us about the inciting title of his talk, From the Rivers of Babylon to the Coronary Bloodstream. Barry.
I'm truly delighted to be here and profoundly honored. First, I'd like to thank the selection committee. I understand the rigor of the process, so I'm particularly honored by that, given the distinguished members who serve on that committee. As you've heard, my personal relationship with John Gallen makes this a most meaningful opportunity and honor for me. I'm delighted because this is the NIH Director's Lecture Series, and I'm a great admirer of Dr. Zahuni's commitment to the roadmap, the process by which it was developed, and in particular, the exciting opportunities that are now furnished by the Clinical and Translational Science Award Program that we feel very, very pleased to participate in at Rockefeller University. Most importantly, this institution made my career possible. Harvey Gralnick selected me when I was a fourth-year medical student and had very, very little research experience and took me into his laboratory. And as a late bloomer, I had the chance to learn science and to develop the skills of translational science to be able to have my career. Without any exaggeration, I owe my career to this institution. I realize the title of my talk is a little unusual. I hope that it will unfold. I'm going to split it into three parts, really. First, I want to talk a little bit about translational research, since that seems to be on a lot of people's minds. Then talk a little bit about my own research, and sum up with some of the more recent clinically relevant materials that relate to the monitoring of platelet function. First, my disclosures. I have, as you've already heard, been involved in inventing things, so I have royalty interests in abciximab, which is something I will mention, as well as the Verify Now assays, and I'll be saying more about them. And I serve on the scientific advisory board of the company Acumetrics, which is involved with the assay. I bring you greetings from the only other hospital in the United States that is devoted to its research mission as its primary mission. The Rockefeller University Hospital has a proud history, being founded in 1910. And there have been some astute clinical discoveries at Rockefeller, and I just chose three. One about 1944, that DNA transmits genetic information, Avery, McLeod, and McCarty. And that came out of studies of pneumococcal pneumonia, which were a major focus of the hospital for many years. Vincent Dole, with his colleagues, including Mary Jean Creek, who is now, in fact, still at Rockefeller, were the ones who identified the fact that methadone would be an effective maintenance therapy for patients who had substance abuse. And David Ho, with the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center, conducted his studies as part of Rockefeller University's hospital in the 1990s and developed the highly effective antiretroviral therapy for HIV. What excites me about translational research is the ability to unite humanism and science in the service of medicine. And these two keep intersecting in ways that are very powerful and meaningful. And that's really the theme that I want to develop. So for me, articulating this core principle, it took me a while to actually understand what motivated me, but this is in fact what it is, and that is realizing that the power of the scientific method could actually improve health and alleviate suffering from disease, and that really is perhaps our proudest achievement. And being able to participate in that process is a privilege. Very few people have that privilege, and I duly appreciate that it is a privilege. And the key corollary, then, is that research is not one of the three missions of academic medicine. From my standpoint, it is the mission. Some of us were brought up on this image of the three-legged stool of research, patient care, and education as being separate and essentially distinct disciplines. And I think this image is wrong. It had its virtues, but I think it's wrong, and I think this is the right image. And it's really a four-legged stool with a cushion, with us making a commitment to bring the scientific method through research to all of the things that we do, and now I think a focus on community service and global health. And since I am a product of the 1960s, for me those have always been linked to issues of social justice as well. And that's how I see science and translational science as contributing. So I offer my own brand of translation, of translational research. I like the broadest definition, which I would just say is the application of the scientific method to address a health need. And translational research, I think, does differ from scientific discovery in a number of ways, but here I've tried to offer you what I epitomizes to me the conceptual difference. The scientific discovery has a beautiful aesthetic. There's a paradigm. There are implications of the paradigm. If the paradigm is correct, those can be tested directly. If the data support the paradigm, great. If they don't, equally good or even better. That means there'll be a new paradigm. And the goal is to get knowledge, whichever way it turns out. Translational research actually starts with defining a health need. And the final goal is not just improve knowledge, but actually improving health, which means that it's much riskier, much less likely to succeed, because we almost never have all of the information we need at the time we embark on a translational study to know for certain that we'll achieve the goal we prefer. I think there have really been three major, what I'll call completed scientific revolutions, that which we recognize as reductionist science, starting as observational, and then moving only to experimental roughly 160 years ago. And that's amazing to think how recent, 150 years ago, how recent that is. Up until then, humans were not fit subjects for experimentation under any circumstances. The whole science of controlled clinical trials, 1948 was what is usually considered the first modern controlled clinical trial related to anti-tuberculous therapy. And I put 1962 there because that was the first time that the FDA required that a new drug had to show, or a device had to show, that it was both safe and efficacious, that it actually had to do something good. And that led to the need to be able to establish that beyond a reasonable doubt, and that led to the science, the modern science of clinical trial design. And of course, public health has been merged into what's now called health services research or outcomes research, and now it has a very robust basis for approaching major issues related to populations. For those who are younger and or those who are eager for a new challenge, I'd say there are four incomplete scientific revolutions, places where we have not devoted science in the same focused way as we have in the reductionist sciences. And those include medical education, where sometimes people who are very rigorous in their own laboratories will come to a curriculum committee meeting and have a discussion that may not be really evidence-driven. I'm delighted that people here, Ezekiel Emanuel and his colleagues, are leading medical bioethics into an empirical base, since I think that that will advance the field greatly. I think that we need to make connections between neuroscience and behavior, since Modifying behavior can have such profound positive impacts on health that the opportunities there are so extraordinary. And over lunch, we had a discussion about making more scientific advances in the way we categorize clinical observations. So if you're a translational scientist, if you're interested in disease, you wind up using a lot of different techniques. And every time a new technique becomes available, you have the excitement of applying it to the subject that interests you most. When I started my career, that looked like it was the end of it, meaning that that's what I would do. And I remembered thinking, would I be happy if all I did was to contribute to understanding the pathophysiology of disease? And I was quite content with that, because all we would do is get to that point, and then somebody from a drug company would hear what we said, and they would see the possibility of a therapeutic target. Sometimes our ideas could lead to a prevention strategy or a diagnostic strategy as well. And the drug companies had the opportunity to develop assays to test whether or not modifying that therapeutic target would actually result in an effect that seemed like it might be promising. And the reason that I show this slide is to show you that on the left side, monoclonal antibodies, peptides, recombinant proteins, and libraries of small organic and other types of libraries of compounds, when I started my research career, not one of them was available. So before I talked about my sense of privilege, this is a sense of empowerment, the opportunity to actually now, in an academic setting, having opportunities to do this provides us with tremendous, tremendous advances in our ability to translate new science into something of benefit. And of course, the rest of the paradigm you know very well, medicinal chemistry, animal models revolutionized by transgenics, and then of course we're now into the science of clinical trials and approved therapeutics. I think this is often where people don't focus enough on this last slide, because almost always the first indication and the first dosing and duration of an approved therapeutic is virtually never its optimal one. And so the opportunity to, through understanding refined pathophysiology, to find new indications for already approved medications, or to optimize the therapeutic use by clinical assays and observation, I think are really crucial components of the translational paradigm. So I'd like to put forward the essential skills, only three, of the translational research investigator or team. If the team is a coherent, integrated team, it makes no difference if this is one person or more than one person. But I think these are the three skills, and I think training should focus on these three skills. The first is the ability to articulate a health need with the precision of a basic science hypothesis, not just a casual discussion of a health need, but a very precise one. The ability to create a robust and practical assay, molecular, cellular, or organismal, and I didn't have room on the slide, but actually this could even be a population-based assay, that allows you to begin to address that health need, to see whether or not you can affect something on a small scale that you think will then be extrapolatable and will be biologically and medically meaningful enough that if you affect the assay the way you want to, when you back it up into a whole person or into a population, that the benefit will be what you anticipate. And that requires an enormous integration of both scientific and medical knowledge. And the third is the ability to, at least at the conceptual level, design a phase 3 study to assess safety and efficacy before embarking on the project. That's not to say that you wouldn't embark on the project anyway, but to be sure, you want to know whether or not you can think of a way to actually demonstrate the utility of what you're doing. And by that I mean that there are enough patients to study, that the statistical issues, the ethical issues, and the issues related to the Food and Drug Administration, that you at least have a sense that, in fact, at the end of the line, you'll be able to meet the criteria for approval. And now let's move on to the patient that triggered a lot of this. This patient was a 40-year-old Iraqi Jewish female who had a lifelong history of easy bruising, heavy periods, bleeding from her gums, and gastrointestinal hemorrhage. She had already needed 200 platelet transfusions by the time I met her. And her platelets simply didn't clump together with any of the agents that ordinarily cause platelets to clump. And I mentioned that the patient was from the Iraqi Jewish population, where they have a high frequency of this disease called Glanzmann thrombosthenia, which is an autosomal recessive disorder. And the reason that they have a high frequency of the disease is because there's been a lot of intermarriage within this group. And this shows you the Babylonian campaigns of the period from 609 to 586 BCE. And you can see on this slide that, in fact, Babylon over here, which is only about 60 miles from modern-day Baghdad, and there was, in fact, an invasion, and there was ultimately the capturing and the destruction of Jerusalem, and the Jews were taken back to Babylon in captivity, and remained there in large part until about in 639, Cyrus the Great, the Persian, in fact, defeated the Babylonians, and the Jews were allowed to go back to Jerusalem, but some stayed in Babylon, and they stayed there from 586 BCE until about 1950, when about 100,000 or more moved to what is modern-day Israel. Those who know Psalms may recognize this psalm, which is Psalm 137. I just took two lines from it. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. So this group intermarried from 586 BCE and in a very small group, and in fact that allows one to understand the high frequency of this recessive disorder. So these are blood platelets. On the left are the platelets when they're unactivated. When they get activated, they undergo a change of shape. And ultimately, as you can see up over here, they start to clump together. And the way we measure platelet aggregation is by having platelets suspended in plasma, letting light shine through. When the platelets clump, the light goes through much more easily, because the amount of light that's reflected back depends upon the number of particles rather than the size of the particles in large part. So if we, in fact, take normal platelets and we add ADP, the platelets change shape and then they start to aggregate, showing by the reduction in the optical density in the cuvette. A patient's platelets, however, simply can't clump. And that's true whether we use ADP or another agent like epinephrine. The patient's platelets simply can't clump. And this is an early study showing what the proteins are in a normal patient's platelets, in this column over here, and one of the patient's platelets. And you can see that there's missing in the patient's platelets this band over here. In fact, there's another protein missing down here, but it's not quite as obvious on this type of gel. This is glycoprotein 2B. It's also called alpha-2B. This is glycoprotein 3A, also called beta-3. And so these patients were missing this receptor made up of two different subunits. And if you look carefully, the patients are also missing in their platelets another protein called fibrinogen. John Finlayson here worked on fibrinogen when I was at NIH, did some of the very elegant biochemistry. And fibrinogen is a dimeric molecule which has highly asymmetric, has a very large molecular radius, and sure enough, the very ends have the information for binding to that platelet glycoprotein 2B3A receptor. And so we made an assay early on in which we just took some fibrinogen and put them on beads and saw what would happen if we added platelet-rich plasma. That's this PRP down here. And sure enough, the platelets interacted with the beads and caused the beads to clump. And this was not nonspecific, because if we took beads and coated them with albumin, we did not see the same thing happen. And so this was our assay. As soon as I heard about something called a monoclonal antibody when I was at Stony Brook, I begged to gain access to the facility so that I could make some antibodies against platelets. And I knew just what I wanted. This was just at the beginning of the understanding of how platelets aggregated. And what I wanted was something that would prevent the interaction of platelets with fibrinogen, because at that point, I was willing to guess that that interaction was going to turn out to be really important, and there were already studies from several labs suggesting that fibrinogen bound to platelets when they were aggregating. And so here are the aggregated beads in the control, and here's one antibody that we work with quite a lot called 10E5. Here are other antibodies that don't react with the platelets to prevent the clumping. And these are positive controls, chelating the calcium or a small peptide that's known to interact and prevent the receptor from working. So this was a very macroscopic. We just looked under with a magnifying glass, and you could see which clones were in fact causing the inhibition. And the 10E5 antibody could actually completely recapitulate the defect that we found in the patient's platelets, as you can see here. So these are normal platelets now, but with the antibody on a normal platelet, they can't clump any better than the patient's platelets because the patients are missing that receptor. And we immediately wanted to look for some way to use this antibody in some medically meaningful way. So we went back with our good friend Uri Seligson in Israel and studied patients both from the Iraqi Jewish population and patients from the Arab population who had this disease. And you can see over here, this is an old slide, which I like to keep for historical reasons, that about 40 to 50,000 molecules of the 10E5 antibody will bind to normal platelets. Carriers, we were hoping that we could use this for carrier detection, bind on average about 50 to 60% of the normal number. And the patients, whichever group they came from, bound essentially none. But you can see there's overlap between these groups, so we could never use this for carrier detection. But we had no trouble differentiating these two groups from this group, and carriers are asymptomatic, and therefore we could use this for prenatal diagnosis. And that's what we did with Mr. Rodek in London and the late Ruben Mibishan. Mr. Rodek initially got pure fetal blood for us, and I flew to London, set up the assay. Patients flew from Israel and had this done by fetoscopy. Very quickly thereafter, the technology improved so that virtually all experts in the field could obtain pure fetal blood by ultrasound-guided percutaneous techniques that didn't require fetoscopy. And so this field moved very, very rapidly during the time we were doing these studies. At about the same time, people began to clone these receptors and understood that, in fact, the receptor we were looking at, alpha-2B beta-3, was one of a very large family of receptors called integrin receptors, each of which is a heterodimer of a beta subunit with an alpha subunit. Some betas can interact with many alphas, and some alphas, like alpha V, can interact with many betas. But this is where we are over here, and the other receptor like it has the same beta-3 but interacts with alpha V. And these receptors are very important in leukocytes, in immunology, in cell development, in metastasis formation. Almost everywhere where an adhesion phenomenon takes place, an integrin receptor is participating. So back to our patients, it turned out that immunoblotting was now becoming available, and we could see that the Iraqi Jewish population of patients differed from the Arab populations in terms of their immunoblotting of that beta-3, the glycoprotein 3A or beta-3. And all of the Arab patients we studied had some, very little to be sure, but some, whereas there was none that was detected in the Iraqi Jewish population. And this is an old slide showing what we was known about these receptors at that time. And here you can see that alpha-2B is a transmembrane protein with a cleavage over here, four calcium binding domains. And beta-3 has lots of cysteines, 56 cysteines. It's also transmembrane and very complicated loop structure. In addition, we know that we began to look at the patients, and over here is the Iraqi Jewish patient's defect in almost all of the patients from that group. Terminates the chain just before the transmembrane domain, and as predicted from the immunoblotting, the defect in the Arab population was a small deletion in alpha-2B, but one affecting a cysteine residue that presumably led to alterations in the protein. And then this led us to be able to offer prenatal diagnosis not by fetoscopy, but by chorionic villus sampling, so that it could be done instead of having to wait till 18 weeks of age. It could be done at about 11 weeks of age. And this is our first chorionic villus sampling study, in which you can see that this is from one of the Arab families, and you can see that in a patient, their PCR products run more rapidly because of the deletion than the control. And the fetus at risk is heterozygous, and again, as a carrier, that means that that they're not likely to have any symptoms. And this is, of course, the greatest joy anyone can have. This is one of the families that participated in our studies, and this also gives me a chance to recognize my dear colleague and friend, Uri Zelikson. So how do platelets do what they do? Well, ordinarily, you have an intact blood vessel that's lined by endothelium, and the minute that the endothelium is disrupted, in fact, it exposes proteins that are either deposited underneath or get deposited from plasma with a disruption. And these proteins, like von Willebrand factor and collagen, the platelet has on its surface constitutively active receptors that interact with them. And stripping away the endothelium does something else, because the endothelium isn't just passive, it also is actively inhibiting platelet activation by creating, by synthesizing nitric oxide and prostacyclin, and having on its surface an enzyme that digests ADP. And after this step occurs, the platelet undergoes an activation process that leads to a change in the conformation of that alpha-2B beta-3 receptor, and then fibrinogen can bind, or von Willebrand factor, which is another large multimeric protein. And when that happens, because fibrinogen, as I showed you, is dimeric, it has the ability to interact with two different platelets simultaneously, and this then leads to this tinker toy image. For the people who are more interested in white cell biology, the platelet will then make available on its surface P-selectin, which will then, in fact, recruit leukocytes to this area through their counter-receptor PSGL1. So we've moved now from the disease affecting one in a million to the most common cause of death in the world, cardiovascular disease. And these are world mortality from 1990, and it's sobering to see what is the number two cause of death in the world, since it's completely preventable, primarily relating to the lack of availability of clean water. And here's the central paradigm of the field. You're born with a normal blood vessel. When you get to be about the age of an intern or a postdoc, you start to develop some changes in the blood vessel of bland atherosclerosis. And when you get to be about my age, well, the plaque might rupture. And when the plaque ruptures, you have what I call the most profound biologic misunderstanding. Because when that plaque ruptures, what the platelet sees is exactly the same proteins it would see under the blood vessel wall if it were damaged. And now when the platelet deposits, instead of stopping you from bleeding, it in fact closes off the vessel, and that leads to a heart attack or a stroke. Now, from an evolutionary standpoint, I think that our hemostatic systems have been revved up, because people were at risk of dying from hemorrhage from birth on, and the likelihood of making it to the age of sexual maturity and passing on one's genes probably was a function of how good the hemostatic system was. And since we're talking about population genetics, which almost always has to do with fertility, in fact, my own belief is that probably the risks of postpartum hemorrhage have been the major contributor to why our hemostatic systems are in fact revved up, why our platelet count is 10 times higher than it needs to be to stop us from bleeding spontaneously, why in fact one can be on aspirin for the better part of one's whole life without major problems most of the time, while why one can be on warfarin for long periods of time or heparin or for short periods of time, all of those together in combination even with a thrombolytic agent. So why hasn't there been a lot of evolutionary pressure against thrombosis? And the answer is, for the most part, it occurs after people have stopped passing on their genes, and so it has much less of an effect. For all practical purposes, one is genetically dead. Now, I can speculate, however, that it's much more important to keep grandmothers around than grandfathers, because grandmothers transmit useful information about child rearing. I suspect grandfathers, like myself, mostly in the olden days, just ate and took up space and didn't do very much in the way of hunting and gathering. So I think that there's perhaps something hidden in that. Well, this is the disease process that now statins and many other things are lessening, fortunately. But what really kills you is that final platelet driven thrombus. And here's this really smart platelet finding the one discontinuous area in the lining of the blood vessel. But the first layer really of platelets doesn't do much. Even in this capillary, you can see the red blood cells can get through. The real danger is this process of the platelets heaping up and then closing off the vessel. Now, this is a study we did in the carotid artery of a mouse. The carotid artery of a mouse is about 0.7 micra in diameter. And I can tell you that a coronary artery, about 0.7 millimeters in diameter, not micra, it's about 0.7 millimeters in diameter. The coronary artery of a human is about 3 millimeters in diameter. But from that image I showed you of the atherosclerotic process, there are a lot of humans walking around with blood vessels roughly of this size. And when we damage the endothelium, if we strip off the endothelium with chemical ferric chloride, you can already start to see this white haziness on the side of the blood vessel by 3 to 4 minutes. And that's really pure platelet clumping. Platelets depositing one on top of another. By 4 minutes, by 6 minutes, it's almost completely occluded. And in another half a minute, you'll see that essentially there's no blood going to be able to go through that vessel. Oh, wait, one. There it is. Okay. So it's all over in 6.5 minutes just by stripping off the endothelium. If we take a mouse, this is a mouse that was made by Richard Hines and Steve Teitelbaum that we participated in its characterization. And here this mouse is lacking the beta-3 integrin. And if you lack either of the alpha-2B or beta-3, you won't get the receptor on the surface. But if you take this mouse who now has no alpha-2B beta-3, is essentially like the Iraqi Jewish patient, we could keep going all day. There will be no closing of this. This is 20 minutes and counting. But essentially the platelets simply can't clump, can't close off that vessel. And that's what encouraged us to think about whether or not if we went after this receptor directly rather than the other antiplatelet agents that are known, that it might be an attractive target. And this is just showing a little bit about the different forms of the antibody we used, ultimately working with the scientists at CentiCor to make a chimeric FAB of another one of our antibodies, 70E3. And chimeric 70E3 FAB is in fact the drug abciximab. And here we could show that if you increase the concentration of antibody in the test tube, when you got about 80% of the receptors blocked, you could completely block aggregation. And if you gave this to a non-human primate or to a human, when you reached 80% receptor blockade, you would essentially eliminate platelet aggregation. And now we come back to the importance of the phenotype of the glandular thrombocythemia patients in making a guess as to whether or not this would be or would not be a tolerable and effective antiplatelet therapy. I've already told you that the carriers are asymptomatic, so we know that you can block 50 to 60% of the receptors without causing a major impairment in hemostasis. And I've already told you that the patients have variable mucocutaneous hemorrhage, intermittent severe GI hemorrhage, and that really depends on their good fortune or lack of good fortune in terms of the vasculature in their GI tract. And they'll bleed for sure with tooth extraction, surgery, and after delivery if they're not appropriately treated. But the most interesting thing, and again a rather subtle feature of their phenotypic bleeding, is in fact that spontaneous central nervous system bleeding is rare in patients, unlike, for example, hemophiliacs, which just shows you how little we really understand about organ-specific hemorrhagic risk and why I think it is so important to have an idea of the subtle phenotypic features. Because this was, of course, the major concern, because even if you have an effective anti-thrombotic agent, if the trade-off is going to be a huge increase in central nervous system hemorrhage, that's simply not going to be acceptable. So we had reason to hope, by a careful assessment of the patients, that maybe this would be useful. But we didn't know it through much of this that people would be putting in roughly 1 million stents a year in the United States by the time all of this was starting to happen. That was a rather interesting phenomenon, one that I surely would not have predicted when I left medical school. This shows you one of the recent drug-eluting stents. The picture is beautiful. It shows this perfect vessel with this perfect stent. If you think about the vessel I showed you before in that atherosclerotic process, and now think about what this stent is doing to it, and then think about the slide I showed you where the most minor disruption of the endothelium exposes proteins, well, I don't have to paint too much of a picture for you that it really doesn't look like this. In fact, you start pushing the gruel into the lumen as well as damaging it. So for sure, I don't think there's ever been a stent placed that didn't wind up with some platelets depositing, and how many deposit and what they do, I think, is really becomes the issue. So I'm going to show you just one phase 3 study. It's one that is more of historical interest because this field moved at warp speed for a lot of reasons. But I think that I'll just show you one to give you a sense of the flavor of this. So this was the EpiStent study with apixaban, and the key endpoint was 30-day death, heart attack, or need for an urgent intervention. The drug reduced that risk by 50%. The absolute risk reduction was over 5%, so that's like better than 1 in 20 benefiting, and this was statistically significant. And a related drug, which I'll mention just briefly, called eptifibatide, showed similar trend. What we're still working on was this observation, though, and that was that there was also a 58% reduction in one-year mortality, with most of these deaths not occurring when the drug was given. The drug is given only for 12 hours at the time of the procedure, and most of these saved deaths were, in fact, months later. And we're still working on understanding that. And the absolute risk reduction was 1.4%, which may not seem like a lot, but if you start to multiply it by the number of people getting stents each year, is quite impressive. And again, eptifibatide showed similar trends. Now, there was increased bleeding with this drug, and that almost led the FDA panel not to approve it. And we have Dr. Alving here, who can testify to that since she was on the panel, and I actually presented before the FDA panel in this very room at this very, maybe not quite this podium, but one that was in a similar position. And you can see that there was an increase in bleeding, almost a twofold increase in bleeding in the first study. But then we learned a lot about the use of heparin in this patient population and how to take care of the vessels that were damaged with the angioplasty, and we did additional studies and could actually drop this by a log, and similarly could drop the control group because people were learning more about how to do these procedures and avoid the hematomas at the groin. And again, I just want to show you very similar trends with eptifibatide, and the lesson of this slide is that you have to be very cautious about interpreting new technology that still may be in its growth phase of learning in terms of understanding what its total benefit may turn out to be. And going from just one phase 3 study, but I think this is an interesting, but again, inferential data, but now we're up to over 60,000 patients, and they just looked at patients treated over a period of time when this technology was coming in as to whether or not the hospital did not use these drugs at all or did use the drugs a lot. This is 30 to 85% use. This is 1 to 5% use. And even unadjusted or adjusted for the risk of the patients, there was almost a 50% reduction in in-hospital mortality. Now, of course, there are many other confounders here that may explain the differences between hospitals that adopt early or not. So it's, again, only inferential. But now let me give you an anecdote, because I know we are in Washington, and I'm old enough to remember when President Eisenhower had his heart attack. And a recent book was written about this. It was 1955. He was the president. The stock market crashed. The country was in turmoil. To have a president at that time, people had heart attacks. People didn't even talk about it because it terrorized the population in the United States. His doctor was with him, but he didn't even send him for an EKG. He just watched him. Fortunately, they had morphine, and especially fortunately, as I'll point out in a minute, they had heparin and warfarin. It's not clear whether he did or did not get atropine, but he got what was considered to be standard therapy, standard of care, which was absolute bed rest. In fact, he was part of, Dr. Levine had this very weird idea that maybe you should let patients sit up with a heart attack. Because patients were kept with a bedpan and complete bed rest. That was the accepted therapy. They did sit him up twice. They didn't like what his pulse did. So instead of 6 weeks of bed rest, he was kept for seven. He was not allowed to dangle his feet until the beginning of the fifth week. And at that time, the mortality was 30%. Vice President-elect Cheney in 2000 was in the angioplasty suite within a couple of hours. According to the New York Times, these are the drugs that he was given. Suspicion is that probably these other drugs that are now available have also been made available to him. You may remember that he actually walked out of the hospital, insisted on walking out of the hospital in less than 2 days. He was back at his desk in 7 days, and now instead of 1 in 3, 1 in 20 are the expected mortality. So we've also used these antibodies, though, to learn more about the basic science. And I'm delighted that Sam Zhao is here today, because this is TENI-5 again. And TENI-5, many years ago, we had discovered, did something really unusual. And that was that it could hold the complex, the two receptors together, alpha-2B and beta-3 together, even when we did things that usually make them come apart. And this is just looking at the little a portion of the receptor. This is the headpiece of the alpha-2B propeller, and this is the portion over here. And so Tim Springer's group, and Sam led these studies, made use of this, and we supplied the TENI-5, and TENI-5 helped to keep this fragment together so that it could actually be crystallized. And so this provided the first crystal of alpha-2B beta-3, or a portion of alpha-2B beta-3, and it builds on work from Dr. Springer's lab and Dr. Arnaud's lab and the related receptor alpha-V beta-3. And this is just to show you now the crystal structure reconstruction models, if you will, based on the multiple crystal structures of these two different receptors. And this is, ordinarily the receptor is bent. This is just showing it in an extended form, and this is where the actual binding of ligand occurs. And Sam's studies also showed the two drugs, that small molecules that are approved for treating patients, epafibatide and tirofiban, showing precisely how they interact between alpha-2B and beta-3, right in this little pocket over here. And actually, 73 binds right along this ridge. And we know that from other studies. So this is where all of the action is. And so we think that the way in which the conformational change occurs is through intracytoplasmic changes with TALEN binding underneath here to the cytoplasmic domain of beta-3, transmembrane domain changes, and then leading to disruption of these head-tail interactions, and then leading to this structure that's extended, and then this remarkable swing-out motion, which I'll show you in a little bit more detail, perhaps driven by ligand, perhaps partially driven spontaneously. And this is one of Sam's beautiful movies showing Tyra Fibon coming down and now interpolating from the alpha V beta 3 crystal to the alpha 2B beta 3 crystals that he studied, showing the swing out motion that occurs. And presumably this is part of what triggers the outside in signaling that also is very important in platelet function. Now we've also taken that same fibrinogen assay and now done high throughput screening. And this is just showing the assay modified instead of on beads. It's on the surface of a 384-well plate. And these are the way we let the platelets sit down. And out of 33,000 compounds that we studied, we found one of interest. And we're looking forward under the roadmap to, because we were fortunate enough to be able to gain the right to have an additional screening using the roadmap's molecular libraries. We're delighted about that up at Columbia, and that'll give us access to 190,000 more compounds. Now, why are we excited about this little compound? And I hope this will now give some sense of this. This is the alpha-2B subunit, and over here cartoon diagram is the beta-3 with those cations that it binds to. And what's really interesting about this compound is it blocks platelet adhesion, but it doesn't bind to these cation binding sites. And we think that might be advantageous for a number of reasons in terms of potential impact in so-called priming the receptor or inducing changes in the conformation of the receptor that might be involved in the development of thrombocytopenia. So that's just where we are at this moment with this, but we think that there's still opportunities for identifying additional molecules because the oral agents that were developed that look very much like the tyrosine and eptifibatide, in fact, were not effective, and there's still a lot of uncertainty about why that is, but some of it might have to do with these conformational changes. And finally, I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we're trying to do now from the standpoint of translation, because we have drugs out there that I am not sure are being given an optimal dosing and optimal design. So there are activation receptors that are among which include ADP receptors, and clopidogrel blocks one of the seven transmembrane domain receptors. There are signal transduction mechanisms then that transmit this information. And, of course, arachidonic acid getting converted to thromboxane is affected by aspirin. And then we have the direct attack on the alpha-2B beta-3. And, again, we took our fibrinogen assay, but now working with scientists at Acumetrix, redesigned it, and believe it or not, in these little wells over here are fibrinogen-coated beads. And they get mixed by little stir bars over here. And all of this is now fully automated, and all you need to do is take a blue top tube, and it goes, the blood goes in there, gets warmed, and then goes into these reaction chambers. And this is just to give you an idea of what the device looks like. And we've now designed three different cartridges, one for aspirin, in which arachidonic acid is used to activate, one for clopidogrel, which is a little tricky, and we used ADP plus PGE1, and this was to reduce the impact of other ADP receptors that are not blocked by clopidogrel. And this is an assay that was based on using a thrombin receptor activating peptide that we modified a little bit so it wouldn't be digested by plasma. And this was to look at the alpha-2B3A antagonist. But all of them wind up with the same thing, whether they do or don't clump the beads. And this is just to show you that clopidogrel is a drug that is very important now for preventing stent thrombosis. But even at a very high dose, this is a dose that's not, in fact, used clinically. It's above the dose that would be used clinically, that even when you give this very high dose, although many people get inhibition of their platelet function, some achieve much less levels of inhibition. And so the question is, does this make a difference? And I don't have time to build the whole story, so I'm going to show you just one slide from Matthew Price from the Scripps Clinic that he just presented. And this was 380 patients, and they were divided into those who had either low reactivity, meaning that they had gotten a lot of effects of the clopidogrel, or high reactivity, meaning that they hadn't gotten as good antiplatelet effects. And here you can see cardiovascular death was zero in the low reactivity group and higher over here. And in each of these, this is stent thrombosis and this is the composite. So we're just at the beginning of this story, but we're hoping that, in fact, using some of these assays, much like using the prothrombin time, will be helpful. So I'd like to leave you with an image. The image is this. This is Archimedes when he discovered the principle of the lever. The lever gave him mechanical advantage, and he realized that the only thing that counted was the length of the lever. So an infinitely long lever would give you infinite mechanical advantage. And so he said, if you give me a place to stand, which is perhaps a problem, and a lever long enough, and I will move the earth. So this is the image of the translational scientist or translational science team using the scientific method and with NIH support, moving that world toward world health and social justice. And these are the small army of people who really deserve the credit that I have the great good fortune of receiving in the form of your honor today, people who've contributed literally from around the world to our studies of patients with Glanzmann's thrombasthenia. I've already mentioned Sam's work in Tim Springer's lab and June Takagi and others who worked so hard on what was really a monumental contribution. People who worked on the early development of apsiximab at Mount Sinai and Rockefeller and or again throughout the United States and throughout the world. The scientists at CentiCor who made really crucial contributions. People who worked on defining the 73 epitope and the knockout mouse collaborators. And finally, the whole blood assay. And the Rockefeller team and our colleagues at Marta Murthy and Marta Filizola at Cornell and now at Mount Sinai who've worked on the computational studies that I showed you and the docking studies in particular over here. So with that, again, I just want to thank you for this great honor and for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you today.
Thank you, Barry, for a great talk. We can have a couple of questions, but our plan is then to adjourn to the refreshments, and Dr. Kohler will be available for more questions.
Congratulations for an excellent review and outstanding work. The question relates to the use of some of these peptidomimetics, tyrosine type of molecules. You think they will someday replace it, or you have to continuously use the combination therapy for reducing some of the thromboembolic complications in patients with myocardial infarct?
Right. So right now, one of the reasons that I emphasize that the data I showed you is historical is that bivalirudin is clearly now having an impact on, in terms of where the alpha-2B beta-3 antagonists belong. Their scope of indication is narrowing as bivalirudin, the data from bivalirudin comes through. The other thing is that the study I showed you was in the era of ticlopidine. Clopidogrel's onset of action is more rapid, and therefore the issues of the proper dosing, whether or not apsiximab is in fact being given optimally now, frankly, I don't think it is. I think probably it should be given perhaps, or it should be tested to see if giving it only as a bolus would be beneficial, and even whether or not it should be given intracoronary. So this field is just moving at lightning speed, but also the stakes are much higher with the drug-eluting stents because there's more anxiety now about late thrombosis and whether or not that could potentially be impacted early on or whether or not people are going to be on these drugs for a long time. This week you'll read about, if you haven't already seen the press reports, about prasugrel, which is another agent that blocks the same receptor as clopidogrel. And what's very interesting is that they got a beneficial effect with the first study, but in fact the bleeding risk went up, including intracerebral hemorrhage in that setting. And that's of great concern. And the interesting things to me were that lighter patients, patients who weighed less, the least amount, had the most serious bleeding problems. So I believe that, in fact, dose adjusting of that drug might actually bring tremendous value in terms of trying to optimize its use. And I believe that in their next study, they're going to actually be monitoring a significant number of patients to see whether or not the impact on platelet function correlates better. Yes?
Are there any known genetic influences in terms of responsiveness to antiplatelet therapy?
Responses to which thing now?
Therapies.
Yeah, there have been reports that one of the known polymorphisms in glycoprotein the glycoprotein 3A or beta 3 correlates with responsiveness to abciximab. I think that it was a relatively small study and it's not so clear. Ultimately, I'm sure that there will be genetic influences. And in fact, we know that there's a wide range of platelet responsivity that's unaccounted for by anything we currently know. And so people are doing genome-wide searches now to identify that, because those factors may in fact be the crucial factors in why some... I didn't get a chance to talk about aspirin. Some people who don't respond as well to aspirin, that may in fact be a reflection not of a unique way in which they handle aspirin, but it may be a reflection of the fact that they have intrinsically higher platelet responsivity because of other factors. So the integration of the of all of the sort of systems biology approach to the pharmacology is going to require, I think, much more detailed study.
You mentioned that the antibody was very effective after one dose, and following that up a year later, there was still an effect. Can you sort of hypothesize why a year later you'd still see a benefit?
Sure. Our hypothesis is like this, and we're now desperately trying to check it. But I think that if you damage the blood vessel, you're going to have some platelets sit down and deposits and embolize, sit down and embolize. When I showed you that the image of the carotid artery, it's not that it just keeps growing like this. It grows and it flakes off and it grows and it flakes off, and you can actually see that. So I think that there's a lot of activation of platelets in small aggregates, and they go downstream. And when they lodge downstream, I think they elicit an inflammatory response. Platelets also, probably because of their importance in wound healing, have a number of factors in them that are able to have an impact on the microvasculature that I think might be negative in the coronary circulation. The one that we're focusing on now is TGF-beta-1. Platelets have almost 100 times as much TGF-beta-1 as any other cell. And again, I think it's because of its role in wound healing. But I think in the coronary artery, if it occurs in the microcirculation, it may elicit a fibrosis response. If it does that, my colleagues who I've collaborated with in thinking about this anticipate that that could lead to electrical instability, because there clearly is evidence that collagen fibrosis results in changes in the way in which the electrical impulse is propagated. So that's our first model, to be sure, to be refined. But that's how we think that if you stop the platelets from depositing early on, that months later, after that fibrotic response has reached maturation, then you have the stochastic probability issues related to an electrical event having the impact on sudden death. So that's the hypothesis.
S- So Barry, you certainly met all our objectives of an astute clinician giving a lecture, and we thank you very much for this great lecture. And we'll now have refreshments just out in the lobby and further discussion.
Thanks. I got this guy.